When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere. Like when your fantasy league meets up at your house. Everything's great until the hot plate gets too hot for the tablecloth. Now your kitchen's up in smoke. And if you don't have the right home insurance coverage, the cost to fix this is anything but a fantasy. So switch to Allstate, save money, and get protected from mayhem like this. Not available in every state. Based on coverage selected, subject to terms, conditions, and availability. Savings vary.
You know what I did before I recorded this? I walked down the street and I lifted up my shirt to reveal my bollocks. Somebody said, "What are you doing?" And I didn't get arrested or anything. And then I came in here and I said, "Well, I'm actually just on my way to record a podcast and talk bollocks." Of course, the name is a little bit fun, but I just really must stress that bollocks boxer shorts are just serving a purpose to remind men to check themselves every time they pull those boxer shorts up. That's why the brand was started. Really good quality boxer shorts, extremely comfortable, really stylish in loads of different colours, and you can use the discount code BARMYARMY to get your 10% off at www.mybollocks.co.uk. And first class Barmy Army members can enjoy even further discounts by logging into their members section on barmyarmy.com. And by the way, you know, if you do want to see a funny video of me flashing my bollocks on YouTube, just go to the Barmy Army YouTube channel. It'll all make sense on there. Let's get into the podcast, where I'll be talking bollocks. Hello and welcome to the Shackles Are Off podcast. Thank you for all the lovely comments and also the entries into our India Series tickets competition. But there's only one place to start, lads. As we record this podcast, England have gone 1-0 up in India. 11 out of 10 performance from the lads, and also 218 out of 10 for Joe Root as well in that first innings in Chennai. As ever, hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm James Gregg. I'm joined by Jack Brooks, a claimant of 475 first-class wickets and Somerset seam bowler. And also...
That's a badger, aren't you?
Yeah, well, too right I am. You've got to be. Yeah. You know, just backing my pals up. Also, Chris Millard, who's a man who's got several 4am starts under his belt in the last few weeks. That's your stats, Chris.
Doesn't sound quite as good as 475 first class wickets, does it?
It doesn't, does it?
I'll take that. I didn't put my dressing gown on at 4am for 5 days. Cheers, lads.
Look, before we get into our bumper episode, because this one is a proper episode, it's one of our favourite guests, I think, that we've had on the podcast series. What a win for England. Chris, you were getting up. I think you're probably more qualified than both myself and Brooksy because you've watched more cricket than probably most people in the country, actually, in the last few weeks. I mean, what a series win that is.
Incredible, mate. Just to beat India, the first test match in Chennai, they haven't lost there for 22 years. For England to go there is just absolutely incredible for the whole team to have really done something during the game, from obviously Rooty leading the line with a double 100, making him the most ridiculous cricketer of the year so far, and the hot favourite for sports personality of the year. Should have got on him early, lads. But no, it was an amazing test, and it was great to see such confidence through the England team, like we were saying off air, just to watch Leechy get a bit of treatment in the first innings. But then to bounce back the way he did shows real character, doesn't it? And then how can we avoid talking about Sir Jimmy Anderson with that unbelievable over? You had to be up early to watch, but everyone who was very thankful, and it will be replayed loads of times around the world. So just unbelievable, mate. Unbelievable.
So good. Brooksy as well. You must be so pleased for Leechy. I mean, your teammate, obviously, he was on the podcast a couple of weeks ago with us, and he was quietly confident, I think. But, I mean, have you spoke to him? What's he said? Because he must be just brimming with confidence now.
Yeah, I certainly think the way he's bowled and the wickets in the second innings, his confidence has gone through the roof. I was texting him last night after the game. And he was saying to us a couple of weeks ago that it's just going to take a bit of time in terms of lack of cricket and wickets and performing. He's a little bit rusty still because he knows what he's capable of, but he has got high standards. And he works so hard. And I'm just really, really chuffed for him how well he bowled in the game and got his rewards in the second innings, didn't he? Bowled some absolute seeds as well, didn't he? To get, was it Pujara and Rohit? Yeah. Balls he got them down. He's a match winner for England in fourth innings. He's done it so often for Somerset. He knows what he's doing. But it's Test cricket. I mean, no one has it easy all the time. I know Ruchi's making Test cricket look incredibly easy, making it look like he's playing against under nines this year, isn't it? But Test cricket is, you know, it's a true test of your skill and patience over a long period of time. And, you know, Rishabh Pant going after him and absolutely clubbing him everywhere. I mean, that's ballsy. You can't do that every game all day. It's just going to go up in the air. You're going to run past one, aren't you? But for Leechy, I mean, that's a small test really as well for Leechy in the grand scheme of things, in terms of what he has to deal with on a day-to-day basis with his Crohn's. He's had sepsis. He's had his action remodeled. You know, he's been tested in far bigger ways than just getting whacked around a cricket ground. So that's something you can enjoy the challenge from and bounce back from. But I mean, what can we say about Ruti? Like, one of the newspapers gave him a 9 out of 10 for the match. And I'm like, what more could he have done? Like, even his 40 in the second innings was played with his piece, wasn't it? So he's next level. His fielding, like, he took that world.
He should have declared early, though, shouldn't he?
Oh, well, don't even get me blooming started.
Should we let Greggy loose on this?
Don't even get me started. You know what? I'm not getting... No, come on. We're in a good mood here, lads.
Now, I understand where Greggy's coming from with the little rant he had on Twitter about this.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed it because I enjoy people ranting in Twitter, and I try not to get drawn into it. And there's obviously so many opinions flying around. It's like arseholes, isn't it? Everyone's got one, and everyone suddenly becomes an unbelievable bastion of knowledge. But when you've got high-profile people sort of suggesting England were being too cautious and drifting a little bit. So at the same time, these guys are there in the game, seeing at the pitch, making sure that, A, they don't want to lose the game. It's a great opportunity to win the game. And yes, if India had blocked out the last day, you'd think, oh, it's a wasted opportunity. But that pitch was never going to get better. It's never going to be easy to bat on.
No.
And when you put that much pressure on a team for a whole game, it takes it out of them.
And you know what I really enjoyed, Brooksy, was, look, you know, and also going back to that, opinions are absolutely fine. And that's great. Have an opinion.
Here he goes.
No, genuinely.
He's off. Right.
Genuinely, have an opinion as much as you want. That's not that, you know, a lot of people tweeted me yesterday, go, oh, you're not allowed an opinion anymore. Well, no, of course you are. You can have as much an opinion as you want. It's the way you express it. That's the thing that I really took issue with. A lot of people were saying, rubbish captaincy, negative, never going to do anything if he's like that. I'm like, hang on, just let the test match finish first until you start saying ridiculous things like that. So that's that was one thing. But, you know, I don't know. Look, anyway, we're not going to go into all that, but that's fine. That's the thing. But also...
We just did.
Also, I know. You know what we did.
We've already gone into it.
I'll just finish off with Ruti. Final words for Ruti on this, because Ruti actually, in his post-game TalkSport interview, you might have seen this, he just said, well, I'd spent more time out there in the middle than anybody else. So I knew what the wicket was doing better than anybody else. So leave it down to me. And I thought that was quite...
It was, It was a mic drop moment without dropping anything, wasn't
it? Yeah, and he said it quite casually. He didn't say it in, with the kind of venom that I've just delivered it with, but he was just, you know, I just thought that was quite telling. So that was...
Well, look, it was just a great win, wasn't it? Just to divulge from away from the issue that was all over Twitter for a couple of days. But isn't it great that so many people are also watching it on Channel 4? It's amazing that Test cricket is.
And what are your thoughts on Channel 4, lads? Because I thought... it was a little bit chip shot, but at the same time, it was a breath of fresh air. But
I'll tell you
Sky,
what.
There's no one better than Sky. Sky do it so well. They're unbelievable. Yeah. And they've got some of the best people in the game, the studio, and everything they do around it. And the Channel 4 studio did seem a little bit chip shot, but Cookie was quality. Rishi Prasad was good. Strauss sort of zooming in every now and then.
Yeah, they had Monty on.
There's just a difference.
I think it'd be good if they had someone else in the studio. But I mean, it was double the amount of viewers, wasn't it, than normal? I think it was over 1 million people watching rather than sort of 500,000.
Yeah.
So it depends on who, what catchment, what sort of age people are and who's watching. I don't mind it. I mean, every now and then I think it's good to have some free-to-air. But Sky,
if anything else, it makes you realise how good of a job Sky do, and it makes you realise how educated and how good NASA, Athers, Wardy, Keys, Bumble are at their job. And just listening to the commentary, obviously it's Star Sports that's streaming it, but the difference between Atherton and Hussein debating what's going on in the game and having unbelievable knowledge just makes everyone so much more understanding of what's going on. And I think that was missed a little bit, but it's one of them. It's much, much better that 500,000 people in the country are watching the game.
Yeah, exactly.
No matter what the production's like.
Great game as well. It was such a good game of cricket. Obviously, it's one of England's best ever test wins, probably. But the series is really going to be shooting up now, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Great advert for the game. And like we did say, like Chris said about Jimmy Anderson, absolutely amazing. Never ceases to amaze, does he? But look, talking of fast bowlers, let's get into our podcast then. So
before we do, though, Greggy, I will just cut in because we have had a little bit of interaction.
Oh, right. Perfect. We'll read it out.
There was a put forth. This was for the last Sri Lanka test, but it's only just come through. There was a cat that was up at 4:30 a.m. every day, and she hasn't missed one day yet. It was sent in by Michelle Holmes, up watching the game. They listened to the podcast as well. Obviously, a very invested cricketing Barmy Army cat. So, Michelle Holmes, nice one. And the only other shout-out we want to give this week is for Carl, who went on his afternoon walk and had a listen to us Muppets with the Leechy and the Bessie pod. And he went on an exactly perfectly timed 51-minute walk, which I think was pretty much the full episode. So, nice one, Carl.
Nice.
We've got anybody out there with dogs or goldfish that want to shout out next time as well. That'd be lovely.
Love it. Well, thanks for getting in touch, Michelle, and with your cat, and also to Carl as well. Thanks for listening. And you can just get in touch with us, info@barmyarmy.com, or just send us a tweet or a DM or whatever it may be. Look, we need to get into the pod because this is a bloody good guest. Well done, Chris, for sort of getting some help and sorting all this out.
Do you know why I did that, Greggy? Because when we were sat there once, we were having a little chat, us three, off air, and Brooksy just went, oh, you know, my dream guest would be, if you could do this, I'd be grateful forever. It would be my life made if you could get me an hour on Zoom with this man. Oh, it would be so good. Brooksy's just like starstruck about this bloke. So I'll let you say who it is, but I just like to say...
You put a little bit of mayo on that, but...
basically, Brooksy, you owe me a pint.
Well, you've put a little bit of tax on that, but... he is obviously one of my top men in cricket who I grew up watching. He's an icon, legend, just a top man. And he's one of the few people in cricket I'd probably be a little bit starstruck with. Love to have a beer with him and talk more, but we had a fantastic chat with him for the pod, so hopefully the listeners enjoy it.
Well, let's get into it. It's Alan Donald, White Lightning. And by the way, Brooksy, he was fond of you. He was really sort of complimentary about your skills and stuff on the pod as well.
He knew who you were.
He did, exactly. Alan Donald knows who you are, Brooksy, which is obvious, you know. Like I said, a man with 475 first-class wickets and 57 List A wickets, is it, or something as well? Maybe more than that, Brooksy. But anyway, his stats. He doesn't even know his own stats, Chris.
Were you looking at the batting stats or not?
Well, you know what?
Nice.
Well, one first-class 100, we know that. We've not heard the bloody end of that on this podcast series.
I'll talk you through it one day, mate. I'll talk you through it one day.
Yeah, we'll do a special bumper episode pod for that. Maybe we'll get Donald on to ask the questions about that. How's that? We'll do that.
Get on with it. Leave me alone.
Let's get on with it. You're right. It's time for White Lightning. Alan Donald, who is episode number 41 on the Shackles Are Up podcast. Alan Donald.
Shambles.
That was a shambles.
You must have a great affinity with England and the county game. Great success at Warwickshire, honing your game, winning trophies. How did it come about in the initial move over? Because you'd had loads of success domestically at home. But what made you sort of make that initial step to come and play county cricket?
Well, look, I think it's every young man's dream, and especially me, when I was in primary school or just going into high school. My uncle was a big subscriber for the cricket magazine and the Wisden magazine, and I just ploughed through those magazines every single day or week or whatever. He had stacks of those things, and I just kept looking at who is playing county cricket. And in those days, you know, you're talking about 1985, 86, you know, the likes of Viv Richards, Malcolm Marshall. These are the household names that we used to go. I used to go and sit with the Cronier family, and they used to have these videos sent over by Alvin Kalacharan. Now, Alvin was our, Kelly was our overseas player for Free State. And he used to bring over like bags of videos of just, you know, we didn't get any live, you know, during the apartheid era, we did not get any live cricket. We didn't get to watch any live cricket. The only thing that was available to us was to have a look at these magazines and videos. And so, and that's where my love for this, I'd say one day I'd love to go and play county cricket. I'm not quite sure where, but I would love to play against those guys. And then I think it was the 85, 86 Rebel Australians, as they used to call them, and Kim Hughes's team that came over here, very strong side. I was selected to play the last test, and that was also Graham Pollock's last test match, unofficial test, in Port Elizabeth. And I did okay in that test match. I didn't shoot the lights out, but I was a scrawny, skinny little thing. Not that much changed anyway, but I was seen running like this stick form type of young, fast, skinny bloke all over the show, wanting to impress. And I remember after the last day, there was a guy by the name of David Brown. He was the coach of Warwickshire. And he used to come over to South Africa. And Warwickshire had this exchange thing with Cricket South Africa back then, where they you know, Brian McMillan was there, Anton Ferreira was there, Hugh Page was there. And then he came up to me and asked me whether I was keen to go and play county cricket. And when I heard that, I, you know, would you come, first of all, would you like to come over for a trial? And I said, absolutely, I'd love it. I'd love to come over there. And that was my break. That was my foot into the door. You know, and I was lucky enough to have had a wonderful career with the Bears.
Yeah. What was that like? I mean, being a competitive overseas player, you said, look, there's some great players playing county cricket at that time. You've got to earn your stripes there, AD, haven't you? You've got to really earn your stripes.
I was right in amongst it. And the big dogs. My first game was against Hampshire, and that was against the great Malcolm Marshall, the Smith brothers. My word, that they have some players. We lost in 2.5 days. Dennis Amos was our captain, and bless him, back then I thought he was a little bit over the, he's just gone over that little peak there where I've gone, mate, he probably, what's he, well, he was about 43, I think he was, And I'll never forget sitting in the stands. I went to the old scoreboard and we were towards the Raybank stand, right on the Raybank stand, playing Hampshire. And we got bowled out for spit and Macko took 12 in the game. And I was sat on the other side there just watching this man just put on a show he wasn't as quick as he used to be then. He was still sharp and skiddy, but the art of swinging and using the crease for me was the greatest lesson of all. And I was competing then with Tony Merrick, who was our overseas player from Antigua. I started off, and then, you know, in about five or six games, I spent the rest of the time in the second 11 earning my stripes. So so back to the second 11 dressing room changing in the cold indoor centre, you know. So, but that's just the way it was, and I just enjoyed it. I didn't think about was I going to come back next year. I just enjoyed it so much. And when when Andy Lloyd said to me, you know, we'd like to offer you a 2-year contract, I was over the moon, and that was the start of a wonderful ride for me with Warwickshire.
Yeah, I mean, look, you look now at the sort of county championship, and it's you know, it's still very strong. There's lots of players, and there's obviously the Colpack system, and it is very strong. But for you, I'm guessing when you came to play international cricket, having experienced a county championship of that standard, you were ready to hit the ground running, basically, as soon as you could play the Test cricket. I might be wrong.
Absolutely spot on. That was the best groundwork that I had to do to play international cricket. And the quality of overseas players that you had there was, how can you not be switched on when you play against Viv Richards or Desi Haynes or Gordon Greenidge right at the start? You know, there I was, jaw-dropping, looking at these guys, this big bloke. And he was a strong, fit man, Gordon Greenidge, and an imposing figure. You know, but just to have had the access to both Desi Haynes and especially Malcolm Marshall playing for, I spent a session and a half sitting in Hampshire's dressing room while they were fielding, and having to listen to just stories of Malcolm Marshall just for a session and a half. It was amazing learning. It really was. And no coach could have taught you anything like that. The information and the access that you had for Malcolm Marshall and Richard Hadlee in 1987. And he was sort of the guy that I sort of latched onto for strategy, for how he set people up, how he bowled people out, what his thoughts were in fast bowling. His theory and his philosophy about fast bowling was incredible. So that was just the access that you had, and it was still the old share a beer or six, and someone driving you home, and just listening to those stories that those guys had to tell. You know, no coach could have taught you anything like those people were, because the best time you learn about the game was in the opposition change room, and that was priceless, absolutely priceless.
Yeah, Brooksy, I was going to say Brooksy.
AD, as a coach, obviously your career's gone full circle now. Now you're imparting your much wisdom onto the next generation. Do you try and encourage the chats with the opposition? Do you think it's gone out of the game a little bit?
What after the game, the day's play? Yeah, we still do that. We try and take their cell phones away from them. and that dominates, and I've seen it, you know, where I've been in the modern day, the game is that right now we say, right, guys, phones in the box, after the day's play, whatever happens, we're going to cross. Obviously, COVID is now put a big halt to that, so it's not going to happen. But now we say, phones in the box, boys, we're going to have a drink, we're going to share some knowledge. You only have to stay for an hour. So we still try and keep that tradition as it is, because the guys, they come to work in the morning, come the ding-dong bell rings and you're off and in the shower and off you go. I understand it's long days, you know, but they don't get any better than out here when it's 34 degrees and you can share a beer afterwards, you know. So we try and still keep that tradition, yes.
Yeah, good. The Castle's too good not to have after a long day in the field.
Yeah, we do have it on tap now, so we have got a players' bar downstairs now. So it's
dangerous.
I didn't say that, but anyway.
Did you organise that, David? Did you organise that?
I certainly did. Yes, I've been a South African Breweries ambassador for a very long time. So it all started as a joke in 2003 World Cup when I said to them that you know, would it be possible to have a draft machine in my house? And I that's never moved. it's been wonderful to come home at 5 PM and just go swee and off you go. You know, so yeah, it's a great time still.
You were basically go on, Brooksy. Okay, so go on.
I was going to say, just finally on that Castle thing, I've got something to own up to because. Like you grew up watching the likes of Lillie and Hadley and those boys and Malcolm Marshall, obviously legends of the game. But I grew up in the 90s watching UAD, and it's this bit of a fanboy moment me here talking to you. And quite surreal and funny is I've got one of your testimonial beer cans at home from your 99 benefit year of Warwickshire.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
My old man, who's a decent umpire, umpired your benefit game at Banbury Cricket Club. You probably won't remember it.
Yes, I do.
I've actually got your autograph and one of those beer cans from the game.
Wow! You know that I did not know that though. You must have been a little weenie man.
I was small anyway, but I was probably about 14 or 15 back then. And I love cricket. The old man got lucky to umpire your, I think he did yours and someone else's the year after at Banbury. But he said he had a couple of memories from the game. One of them was you came on to bowl. I think you're coming back from injury. And you bowled about 3 balls. And then I think it was you or Ashley Charles bowled a couple of balls and then just walked off the pitch.
Yeah, the memories of that day were slightly vivid, but I do remember the Banbury game. It was a very shortened benefit year, that's for sure. Straight after the World Cup disaster in 99, I remember that very well. I only had 4 months really of getting some stuff done, and then we sort of split that benefit year from England to South Africa. But yeah, it was a fantastic time to have a benefit while the World Cup was on in the UK. You know, that opening night in London was surreal. It was unbelievable. One of the best nights I've ever had with so many unbelievable people in that room. I was hoping that the World Cup would turn out a little bit better for us, and the benefit would have tasted a lot sweeter. it didn't turn out to be that way, but there you go, life goes on.
You were we'll come back to sort of that famous week in 91 when you go to India and there's, you know, 100,000 people turning up at the stadium in just a moment. But look, you were the fastest bowler in the world for many years, right? And Brooksy, I'm sure you've got loads of technical questions on this kind of stuff. You know way more about fast bowling than me and Millard do. But nowadays is all the measurements and the fitness testing and there's the stretching and the sort of the diet and all that. Were you a bit ahead of the curve? Because you must have been to be able to maintain that for such a long period of time.
Well, the culture that we had in the Free State has always been fitness first. And that was driven by Hansie Cronje and the coach, Corrie van Sail. And I think if it wasn't for that, I don't know how I would have turned out to be, and because that was part of our DNA. It was, and we still have that. We still have some of the best fitness results in the country. And yes, the game has gone very scientific now. And back in the day where the players used to enjoy a beer afterwards and have fun, and as much as you enjoy relaxing, county cricket, I absolutely realised very early on that if I had to play or make a long career out of county cricket, there's fitness was going to be the key for me. So I had to balance between, because you finish the South African season and you're straight into a county season. And back then in 87, 88, 89 till 90 odd, you played 24 3-day games. Then you had your Sunday league, and you had a Benson and Edges and an NatWest. And it was just ridiculous how many competitions there were. And sometimes you play 2 of the 3 days. That's how stupid it was. You play 2 of the 3 days, you're in Hampshire, you've got to drive to Somerset on a Saturday after the day's play, play a Sunday league match, drive back to Hampshire, finish off the 3-day game, and that's how stupid it was. It didn't happen every week. But look, to come back to that fitness thing, I had to find a way, and it was Hansi Cronier introduced me to a guy at the university where we had to balance out my fitness during a South African season where it was peaking at the start, then leveling out in the middle, and then peaking at the back end to be fit for an English county season. And I had to replicate that and just try and stay as close to that fitness regime in a county season as well, so that I can just have that balance of coming back and doing it again. So, if you ask me how I did it, I simply don't know. But I think fitness and getting stronger and getting mentally stronger was a big issue. I was just blessed that I was lucky. I was elasticated. I enjoyed stretching. I enjoy doing shuttle runs, not so much a 5K or 2K, 3K time trial specialist. I was not a Zola bud. From a long distance or middle distance or short distance running, I wasn't really a super athlete. But trust me, that fitness was a big key in county cricket. It really was. And we all know how many overs we rack up there. It's imperative that you just stay on top of it.
Yeah. Look, let's talk about India when the South Africa team returns to the international fold. You're obviously spearheading the attack. 5 in the first match, wasn't it, in the ODI in front of... I mean, you describe the scenes there because, I mean, it's like a real baptism of fire, that, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we didn't know what to expect when we arrived in India. The 2 days before the game, just the way we were welcomed in India was unbelievably special. Thousands of people lining the streets from Calcutta Airport. And then we had a training session, the first session, and walking into Eden Gardens was wow. It was just, I couldn't believe the size of the place. And they said to us that 2 days before, they said to us that the stadium can take over 100,000 people and it'll be full on Saturday. Well, there was 107,000 people, as a matter of fact, when Clive Rice walked out, and we were told just to go to the center of the wicket and basically say thank you to all the people. And the noise was just unreal. It was, you know, it was in your face. And we thought, if this is international cricket, then we slightly feel intimidated. Not a ball has been bowled yet, but to see all the sea of people. And of course, Jimmy Cook gets the first bowler of Kapil Dev, gets caught gully first ball. And you think, what a start. What a start. Welcome to international cricket. But the way, we were sort of, as much as we wanted to impress and win a game, we were also not worried about the outcome. It was just about just enjoy being in India. The honeymoon period, as Kepler Vessel said, just embrace what we're seeing here, what we're experiencing here. And then, you know, I think even more so, the FIFA that I took that day was a great start to an international career. It was an amazing atmosphere. And, you know, when I think that you, I don't know if you guys have been to India or watched the test match there, but it's 100,000 versus 11 where you're on the park and Tendulkar strokes run through the inner ring and the explosion of the noise is just incredible. Great experience to start with.
Can imagine. Amazing. I mean, absolutely unbelievable. Sean Pollock and yourself, what a partnership for so long as well. What was the method? Did you have a method? Did you discuss things? Were you close pals off the field? I mean, I don't know. I don't know about the dynamic at all.
Yeah, we became an instant, partnership. you know, what Sean brought, and I had to understand his role, know his game pretty well, what he brings and bowling with him and how that bowling partnership works. Because Sean quickly was our Glenn McGrath that locked people away, bowls very close to the stumps, just bowls stump to stump with a bit of shape, and you can express yourself at the other end. So the game really is in lockdown at the other end, where you can express yourself in terms of pace. I think we, it's fair to say that we experienced a very special relationship between me and Sean. It was a great understanding between the two of us. We planned well, you know, in team meetings. Bob Woolman used to break the groups up into small groups where you and Sean go and discuss how you're going to get out number one to four. And that's your role. You guys need to feed back to the team of how you're going to bowl to Atherton or Border or whoever it is. So it was also what we didn't have when Bob Woolman came in. And I think what we sort of take in now into our coaching, and especially my coaching, having learned from Bob Woolman, was that he quickly handed the responsibilities over to, and he sussed out the leadership. Who is your leadership group? Alan, you're the leader of the bowling group. You take care of it. You and Sean, you run that for us. Hansi Cronier, Jock Callis, young Jock Callis, you look after Jock. That's your role. Hansi, look after Jock. You know, so as quickly quickly establishing the little pockets of leadership, and also then your role was to feed back to the batting group and the team of how we're going to do things. And I think that's how I like to do things, because I think the modern day player these days now, they are very quick not to wanting to take that responsibility. Whatever the coach says, if things go south, but that's what the coach says. So, so I think what Bob did so beautifully was to get that in place, and that leadership and that quality in place, that we, and that's where me and Sean really latched on to each other, really well. It became really good mates on and off the pitch, and also at that bowling partnership that everyone talks about.
Yeah.
Can I ask on that? Like, I find it fascinating the mindset of a fast bowler, obviously trying to be one myself for the last 12, 13 years. Obviously not as, nowhere near as quick as you were, as good as you were. But when I came into the pro game at sort of 24, a bit later, one of the first things I was told was to sort of make yourself into an imposing figure, because it's not a contact sport. If you've got any sort of pace or anything about you, you need to sort of get in the game a little bit. And David Capel sort of instilled that into me, as, you know, to put some confidence into me as well. I was just wondering, where did you get your sort of fiery on-field personality from? Was it something that was natural to you? Was it something that you had to work on? Was it something that you really, because you look like you really enjoyed it as well. That's what
it looked
did.
Pretty natural as well.
Yeah. Me to someone like you was obviously a skillful, very quick, good bowler, but also somebody who had bags of on-field personality as well.
Yeah, I have to say, Brooksy, that natural instinct, that natural competitiveness, the absolute desire to smash an opponent came within, and I mean that. I don't think you can coach that. I don't think you can take. We've got a youngster here now, Gerald Coetzee. He's 19 years old. He bowls 150. He is exactly like that. He's an absolute puppy off the field. Nice guy. Brett Lee, when I got to know Brett Lee, exactly the same. He steps across that rope. He flicks another switch. And it's just that ultra competitive hunger to succeed, and to whatever's in front of you, you will deal with. You know how to deal with that. But it's never ever to back down out of a contest. And I think that I would like to think that came naturally to me. I just wanted to compete so badly and wanted to beat an opponent so badly that it just makes you not want to go away. But to take someone and try and say, I honestly feel that it needs to come out of you in a natural way. A lot of other guys, like Morne Morkel, for instance, we could not teach him that. We could not find that mongrel in him that say, Morne, please, can you please bowl a bumper? You know, so, but he got better. he got better because he was a bit more of a, and me understanding Mornay when I was with the Proteas was Mornay would always, and understanding the individual, say, coach, but just give me half an hour of your best, your technical best. And that was him. So giving that technicality first, then take him to a place where he can compete not only in the nets first, but then the confidence that he takes from there into a test match was, I am technically sound. I feel brilliant. I walk today from that net today. I feel 100%. That's unfortunately how Mornay thought about himself, because he had to feel good about himself. But boy, when he got into a contest, and it was him and I think Michael Clark at Newlands, when he absolutely lambasted him all over his body for like 3-4 overs. That was great, great TV. But I think, yeah, I mean, look, I think that comes within Ambrose, Walsh, those guys. You look at them, Craig McDermott, a Cummins of this world, Mark Wood, just all that kind of stuff that it just unleashes from inside.
Do you still have that hunger and desire as a coach, or is it different now you're in a backseat role, or do you still have that real want to win?
It will never go away. It will never go away. But you got to watch how you trade as a coach. I think the modern day coaching has changed in a big way. I just think if you coach with authority, you're signing your own death warrant. If you think you're going to be this guy that enforces all this hoo and ha and a boo and bar and whatever it is, you're in the wrong place. You can't coach with authority. That is one thing, is, you know, so today is about empowering the players. It's about giving those players the confidence to say, you know what, you don't have to worry about what I think up there. Because I've been in that position where coaches, you know, when you bowl two wires in a row and you look up there and Kepler Vessel standing at first slip like this, and the teapot thrown, you look at the dressing room and the coach is going like that, this puts the fear of God in you. You know, it's just, cannot believe this bloke can't land two balls in the straight plate and in the same place, you know, that sort of thing. So there's a lot of fear amongst youngsters today. And the fear comes from, am I still going to have a job if I don't perform? If I don't make 100 or take FIFA, am I going to still be in the team for the next game? There's no consistency. There's no process. Am I going to be okay? You know, he goes home thinking, today I didn't perform well. But meantime, he rocks up every day. He shuts his car door, walks in the change room. He just comes there with fear. So my role is to make sure there's no fear. And the constant message for me driving at home is, guys, go and do your stuff and you don't have to worry about what I think. So, and that's how you, and I think that it shifts, all that negativity and the fear shifts from, you're never going to have a team performances. You're always going to have individual performances. And the culture that you're trying to establish for what we're trying to do here is going to go out the window. So I think so far it's gone nicely, that, you know, you've got a nice bunch of relaxed guys and guys are playing a good brand of cricket at the moment. So there's an art to coaching now, and we can go about it for hours, but I think it's a real skill now to be able to go and create something that is a winning brand. But what is that winning brand?
How difficult is it, though, if you've got external pressures? So in international cricket, it's not necessarily just the coach who's making you nervous and putting you on edge. It's also the whole country, isn't it? And you've seen it a little bit with the South African side, well, a year ago when we were out there, and obviously Du Plessis was under pressure, and it might not have been, he might have had the best coach in the world and he might have had the best advice and he might feel really comfortable when he's training, but you've got the press then. How does that differ then? Because that's a completely different ball game.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is one of rugby is obviously our big sport in the country. Cricket's not a very close second. And then football in this country is huge amongst our country. And then the press just sits on your neck all day long. And I think if you guys think you've got it bad in England, it's It's an ongoing thing that will never go away. This, I think it's pretty much the same as Australia. And it's just they expect success. And it's just, you know, we're sitting in a position now where I think Mark Boucher and his team and what we have in young cricketers mixed with some experience and Faf du Plessis' calmness and leadership in the group there. You've got a young captain in Quinny de Kock who's learning his trade. And we're a team in transition, and so is all our cricket in this country. There's a lot of young cricketers at the moment here and I tell you what, from a batting point of view, and all of a sudden spinners are popping up from nowhere. The fast bowling stocks are not so hot at the moment. From just looking around the first class circuit, but that's just the added thing about it's been in our. In our sport for absolute, years and years and years, where the pressure is unrelenting. Every day, you know, every time I went out there for South Africa, not only are you presenting your family, but you're presenting the whole country, but also you're sort of thinking, you know, you're on a big stage now. If you've got to act out something really special here to get another go, and I guess that's what international cricket brings, is that every single time you get up there, you know, the country expects, the press expects, and all they want is quality. There's no compromise. It's just you got to deal with it, and you got to try and, you know, try to make the best of it as possible.
Now, if I'm allowed, Greggy, I don't know if it's on your schedule, but
yeah,
you spoke about pressure. You spoke about Atherton. We had the pleasure and the privilege of having Jack Russell on the podcast not so long ago. And I think you know where I'm going with this, Alan. But what are your memories from that famous test match and obviously that famous battle with Atherton?
The one in Joburg or the one at Trent Bridge?
The one in Joburg to begin with.
What a knock. And Jack Russell, what an irritating little man he was. I know he would laugh. If he was sitting here looking at me now, he would laugh. He did a perfect job of annoying the living daylights out of people, and he did it brilliantly. I remember we dropped Atherton on 100 that last morning at Short Lake. And then it was about just before tea, I think, Russell, or just after lunch, Russell came in and you think it's just a matter of time before you knock him over. Someone's going to make a mistake. We had Clive Eckstein bowl 60-odd overs, didn't pick up one pole. Merrick Pringle dropped. He dropped Jack. He punched one back at him, second new ball, and he dropped him, caught and bowled. That's probably why Merrick never played again. You're sort of after tea, and you know there's almost 15 overs to go in the day, and things are now starting to stretch out big time, you know. So, and Jack was just a perfect foil for Athers. He's got that horrible little leave. Sort of play and miss leave that you think he's just played and missed that, but he hasn't. And then he'd take one on the body and sort of smile at you with his dark glasses on. Brian McMillan even asked him, he says, "Why are you so private behind those glasses? You're so annoying. You know, just take them off so we can see what's behind those glasses." And that smirk of Jack Russell. And he said to me, "I'll send you the painting of this test match. I'll send you one of those, and you can relive this pain you're going through right now." it was an awesome contest. Walking up those stairs, and I just look at all the England players at their dressing room as they were going in there, high fives. It was like a win. I think the similar thing happened at Manchester in 1998 when England drew that test match at Manchester, that followed on to the duel between me and Athers, when we couldn't bowl England out twice. And the same thing, that joy, that it was a hell of a test series. We should have nailed it. We won at Lord's. We should have won at Manchester. I don't think England would have come back at Trent Bridge the way they did. And that Trent Bridge fight was just one of the best. I wouldn't say one of the best. It's the best contest I've ever been involved in, with one-on-one with someone. You know, when you don't even realize what the crowd says or do or scream and shout, it's just that he could not wait for the next six to rock up there and fire some rockets down. and you hope that Athens is going to make a mistake. And I think that just the way he handled that, whole thing was just sublime. You know, he just never took his eyes off whoever was giving him, who was ever giving it all that. And everyone, the camera's on you. And you watch those replays of me talking to Athens or just saying something very subtle. And I never spoke in Afrikaans with him, never to this day, that I abuse him in Afrikaans. I just want to put that on the table. Yeah. It was flat out in English. But what they didn't show it in there was the amount of noise that was coming from cover, short leg, square leg, that Athens had to deal with as well. And then, of course, the drop catch with Nasser Hussain, he just put the icing on the cake. And that was just, you think, this is it. This cannot be happening. But what a contest to savor. I just respect, absolute respect. And to be able to sit down on the step there, he brought six beers up there and we sat there and he gave me his glove. And he said, have that for your benefit, yeah. You know, massive red mark on the glove. And he was never going to walk for that, and quite rightly so. And how we handled it afterwards, I take my hat off to that.
Yeah,
it was gripping to watch. I remember obviously being a kid then, but even now, if there's any footage of it, which comes up quite often on Sky on a rainy day or on a different highlights program, I'll just sit and watch that. It's incredible. And you were like a man possessed, and it was. I don't know what you were saying. Obviously, you said you weren't abusing him, but
I whispered a few things. It was just there was a lot of other words that I would never ever repeat on this podcast. So, not to mention the little snippets on the way back at non-striker's end that we just had a chat and he sort of just smiled at me. He never said a word back, not a word. It was just a stare. It was almost, go back to your mark, go try again. That was it. That was a message you get. See you later, go try again. And he, you know, if it's dodging bullets from all, you know, but the next day we were done. We were pretty much done. It was an awesome, you know, I keep saying, a lot of the guys now keep saying to me, you know, what was it like? How did you handle it? You know, that kind of stuff. So it's very much entrenched in a lot of people's memories of what happened there that day.
Yeah. Well, you know, you look now and there's the likes of Jofra Archer, and he had that amazing spell against Steve Smith in the Ashes a couple of years ago. Did you see that, AD, the Jofra Archer spell? Yeah. I mean, you look at bowlers like that, Mark Wood elsewhere, you've got, you know, little skiddy bowlers, you know, like people all around the world, there's some fantastic bowlers. Who would you look at most fondly? Who do you look at and you think there's a bit of Alan Donald in them? Who do you look at?
Currently?
Yeah.
I think the guy that I would say, when I go a little bit back, I saw Brett Lee that was a little bit like that. I love Woody. I think Woody is a great competitor. Geez, he'd break ankles to knock people over. I would say a Pat Cummins as well, has got some, you know, he's got something, you know. It's just that I would say Brett Lee was a mean character. And I say that with great respect. Brett Lee was, I don't think, we always talk about batting at the tail against genuine quicks. And Brett Lee, I reckon, was the meanest against the tail enders. He was messy. You know, he hit two of our guys, Mackay and Tini. He could not have smashed the badge more central in front, because Mackay Antini was backing away outside leg stump and he came round the wicket and I thought, oh my word, here we go. Yeah, this is it. This is it. And he hit him square in front, just there. And Mackay just picked it back and threw it back to him. And but I think Brett Lee had that mean streak in him. And I think a guy like Mark Wood and a Cummins today, I think Stark is all right, but I think Cummins for me, those two guys, and Archer's got that West Indies death look, hasn't he? He's got that stare. He's got, you know, doesn't say much, but boy, that little smile and smirk, look out. He can hunt you down. He's got every skill in the world to be able to do that.
Yeah.
I think South Africa at the minute with Rabada and Amrik Nok here have got potential for it to be a special opening partnership for a long time, haven't they?
Definitely, yeah. Nokia has come from nowhere. In fact, I mean, he's been on the radar now for 5 years or so. He's done really well in first-class cricket. He's got a lovely, uncomplicated action. You know, just he's got this action that just shouts out effortless pace. You know, he's a good kid. You know, he's one of those as well. Doesn't say much. Has a bit of a stare and a glare. But I think him and Rabada definitely is going to be a force to be reckoned with, hopefully, in the years to come.
I don't want to put two and two together here, but I know that England are recruiting for a fast bowling coach. And personally, I would love to see AD working with a young Jofra Archer ahead of an Ashes tour. Jack Callis has just come over. Is there a chance we might see you in England colours soon?
Jesus, what sort of a pressure question is that?
I was going to say, who's the journo in this podcast? Plumbing X, fantastic.
Look, I've had the taste of working with England. I've had the taste of 4 months I spent with, I think in 2007, with Peter Moores. I really enjoyed that. I had a great opportunity then when a two-year contract was handed down to me to work with England then, and I just couldn't do it because of my little boy. You know, he wasn't well at that point, so it would have been a selfish thing to do. You know, as chances come and go, you know, jobs come and go. I've always loved working in the UK. I really do. You know, had a stint at Kent and I really enjoyed my time there. Hey, but yeah, maybe you can put a good word in for me. But I'm sure they'll find a good candidate for that. There's no question about it.
Do you think it's any coincidence that Jack Callis has just come to the England setup and Rooty can't stop scoring runs?
Look, if there is ever the most chilled individual that... Oh, there's England just lost the wicket. Oh, my goodness. So, look, I think he'd be a magnificent asset to the England batting. If he does get given a long stint, I don't know how it works. And I think these days, international teams hire consultants on a short basis, stints. And I think it's very healthy for the game to have a guy on the outside who thinks a bit differently, something that the players are not used to. I really think that's really, really cool to have a guy like Jack Callis and just his calm way of explaining about batting. Maybe we all thought sometimes batting comes too easy for Jack and he doesn't have to think about it or overthink about it. And that he genuinely was. And to see a bloke who scored obscene runs and taken a lot of wickets lie on the floor with his eyes closed before he goes into bat and not watch the TV, lie in the change room, and he just said 12th, he must just give him a kick and he's up and he's going. So that was Jack Callis. So by the way, to see him just earlier and sitting there in England colours, you know, so I think it's damn healthy for the game to have a guy like that in, just even if it's a short period. And it's great sharing, something new, it's refreshing. You know, so well done on England for doing that.
Is he one of the most underrated cricketers ever?
Underrated,
absolutely. Yeah, I mean, he's got to be, hasn't he?
Incredible. Still remember his first Test match at the MCG when when these Australians surrounded him. And of course, they'll all tell you that it's a test, a massive test of someone's character, and they're going to test your character. They want to see what's inside you, how big or small your heart is. And the way that Kallis shut all that down was phenomenal. He got 100, and he got 100, just over 100 not out, and we'd managed to draw the game at the MCG. Was an unbelievable effort, and that's how he announced himself. That was just going to be, you know, this kid, whatever he did, you throw him the ball. We heard so many times that he was the reluctant bowler. I can tell you, he certainly wasn't a reluctant bowler, because he could bowl serious wheels. 99 World Cup against Sri Lanka, something pissed him off, and he rocked up, and he came in the change room at Northampton, and he said to Hansi, "I want the ball. I want the new ball." And he bowled 150 with serious shape, and he blew away the top order and threw the ball back, and he said, "My job's done. Whoever that bloke was, he's gone now. I don't need a bowler." But that's his capability. We were spoiled. We had two cricketers in one, and we were very, very blessed to have had Jock Kallis in our system. And what to have played with him and to have shared a dressing room with him as a coach, that was just, you know, you'll treasure that forever.
Yeah, yeah. Go on.
Alan, as it's a Barmy Army podcast, I must ask the question, what are your memories? It was an early Barmy Army when you were playing, but what are your memories from the early Barmy Army in the days that you were battling out against England?
Depends where you are. So if you're in England, you get abuse. No. If you're in England, they're actually quite kind to you. But if you're in South Africa, and in South Africa, boy, oh boy, watch out. Watch out. I'm never downing a beer again at Fine Leg. I remember at Newlands, and we shouldn't be saying this, but that was a good old days. But they were selling these. There was a guy with a half pint, and it was a long afternoon. We were in Cape Town. It was really, really hot. I came down there, and they were singing something about the 99 World Cup. Alan dropped his bat, something. You guys might know that tune very, very well, actually. And I walked down there, and I sort of clapped him, and this guy he stuck his hand out with half a pint. I grabbed it off him, sculled it. And it was the best thing that I'd have never thought anything could taste as good as that. And I was absolutely the legend for the next 4 days, 5 days. For the next test anyway. Coming down there, it was look, they provide nothing but fun, humor, and I think that's what South Africans like about the Barmy Army. Not only can they drink beer, but also, boy, they have fun. You can't get in hotels and bars because there's football on. So, yeah. And it's just I think it's a wonderful concept. It's the only country in the world that has such a magnificent support base. And I know Gossie very well, Matt Goss.
Of course,
to know him and Kent in 2018. What a hoot he is, and of course the man who leads them all with a flag. I forgot what his name is now, guys. So
Vic, yeah, of course. Man,
does he have a mess? He's got the biggest tank in the world I've ever seen. He's just incredible, that man.
No, they're absolutely. Incredible people, shall we say, that there's certainly a certain type to come on tour and support the team all over the world. All the money goes towards supporting England, but we love South Africans, we love New Zealanders, we love Sri Lankans, but you know who the affinity that we share is our hatred towards the Aussies, and I know we share it well with the South Africans and probably yourself.
You're a good bunch, I'll give you that. You're a good bunch. I do enjoy the Barmy Army. They're a fantastic lot.
Oh, I love it. Absolutely love it. For you, AD, then now, I mean, look, you know, where's your coaching career going to take you? Because you must have aspirations for... you know, various things. You've obviously done the franchise stuff. You've had a taste of the IPL. How is all that? I mean, it's a completely different world. And hey, you'd have loved that, wouldn't you? You'd have loved a bit of IPL action if it was around when you were playing.
Look, I've had a front row seat in many change rooms, and I've always been sort of labelled as a specialist bowling coach. And now that I'm in charge of the VKB Knights as the head coach, it's something that I've been wanting to do for a very, very long time. it's always that horrible process of going through an interview just to be told, sorry, but you know, you almost know what's coming. Your experience, your lack of experience as a head coach. It doesn't matter how much experience you have as a player or as a specialist coach, but also can we trust you to do a job as a head coach? And this is my first go at it, you know. So, but to have had access to so many dressing rooms, and especially the IPL, I've had five seasons there, three with RCB, two with disastrous Pune Warriors. But RCB, you can, you know, the amount of knowledge that comes in that change room, and it's not necessarily the coaches. You learn more from the players that come through there than any other coach. You share a lot with coaches. You share a lot. But boy, if once you start listening to a Shane Watson or a Virat Kohli or a Steve Smith, and you listen to about their philosophies and how the game should go forward and what they might try differently about batting or just whatever it may be, man, your jaw drops. And especially a guy like Steve Smith and how he talks about the game, because coaching manuals have got nothing on him. And it just shows you that a guy who's that successful, and the way he bats and the way he plays his cricket and his mindset towards facing what's coming down at him is frightening. It's frightening what he says can be done and where he could hit the ball in any pockets in the field. So, but also with Virat Kohli as well. I mean, I've never seen, and I've always had admiration for this bloke. And when I first got to meet him in 2014, when he became captain, took over the captaincy at RCB. You see international cricketers work hard, but this guy is beyond obsessed with success. And you remember the conversation he had about Indian cricket and where he wants to take Indian test cricket, because he just said, from now on, if you want to play for India, you're going to be fit. You're going to be strong, you're going to be mentally strong, and you're going to meet a certain fitness criteria, which I don't think, and with all due respect, haven't seen in an Indian team. But he wants to be judged on an Indian team winning away from home. He said, we know, we can play in our sleep, we can play in India and roll over teams. And now they've proven in Australia what a resilient bunch they are, with so many players injured and with his leadership that they didn't even have his leadership for only one test. But the way they fronted up to that Australian barrage was, that is just complimentary. Yeah. Absolutely. It was but I mean, it's a wonderful world, a wonderful access as coaches we have now, and the sharing that goes on around the world. And it's, you know, you've got notebooks that you write full of stuff, you know, so it's a great experience. It has been.
Yeah. Hey, we wish you all the best with it. Is there anything else, lads, you want to ask Alan before we let him go? He's given us, you know, so much time. So, anything else, lads? Or have we? We've covered everything, haven't we? Really?
I could ask him, mate, but it'll probably have to be over a bar, in a bar, over a beer.
Sorry, I just lost you there, guys, and you just went all frozen. I didn't know what you said. Sorry.
Oh, it's a good job, really. No, we're only kidding. Brooksy, I think, would like to ask you lots more questions, but I think it'll probably be over a beer. So next time you're over.
Okay, here. Fantastic.
But yeah, Alan, thanks so much for your time. It was great picking your brains, and really good of you to talk to us on the Barmy Army Shackles Are Off podcast. Thank you so much. Really appreciate
Very
it.
Very kind,
Thank
Alan.
For having me. Thank you.
Thanks for coming on, mate.
Cheers, lads. Thank you.
Cheers. See you soon.
All the best.
Podcast Network.